Good morning and welcome back to Nachiyomi. Today we're going to be learning together Divrei Hayomim Beis Perek Chaf, the 20th chapter of the second book of Divrei Hayomim. Our Perek is 37 psukim long, and the focus is the battle of Yehoshaphat against the children of Lot, Moab and Ammon, in the east. The parallel parasha is to be found at the end of Sefer Melachim Aleph, really at the end of Perek Chaf Beis, but most of the story actually is not in Nach beforehand. So this is the first time we're encountering this battle. Let's take a look at it inside. The first two psukim describe a rebellion which is starting. The rebellion comes from the east, from the B'nai Moab and the B'nai Ammon. And we also hear about the Ammonim who are with them. They want to wage war. The messengers of Yehoshaphat come and bring him the message that there's this large gathering of people who are already by the Me'ever Liyam. They're on the by the Dead Sea, Me'aram. They come from Aram and their neighbors. So a few basic points before we go further is, how is this connected to the previous perek? Because it's described as Vayhi Acharei Chein, it is after the previous episode. So some of the Mephoshim say that this is part of the expression of the Nevuah that Yehoshaphat is going to be punished because of having associated with evil people, with Achav. So maybe this battle over here, or this threat of battle, is something which is following in those footsteps. One thing which is a little curious in these psukim is that we hear about the B'nai Ammon and the Ammonim with them. So that sounds like they're two separate entities. Aren't the Ammonim from Ammon? So the Mepharshim struggle with this, and the Radak suggests maybe they're actually from Seir. Seir is the country to the southeast, also a neighbor of Ammon. Maybe they are dressed up as Ammonim. Rashi suggests, based on Chazal, maybe they were Amalekim who were disguised. We've seen that earlier in Tanakh and Parshas Chukas. Maybe there were another nation also called Ammonim, not Ammon. So it's just various options as to who these people could possibly be. One of the messengers relating is about a nation called Aram. Aram is in the north, as we saw. Aram was the nation that was attacking the north and the kingdom of the north. So why are they here in the east? So the Malbim explains that this was actually a mistaken reconnaissance. Because the previous battles had been with Aram, the messenger had thought that this army must be from Aram, but in fact the messenger was mistaken. And they are now in the area of Chatzatzon Tamar, the Ein Gedi area, as they prepare for battle, which obviously is too close for comfort when it comes to this kind of battle. The main question we have to think about in this section is, why is it that these nations are attacking Yehuda, which is under Yehoshaphat, and not the kingdom of Israel in the north? So, and to understand this, the Da'at Mikra points out, we need to understand the background. When David HaMelech became king, he vanquished all of the neighboring states. So Aram, Aram Damesek, Aram Tzova, Ammon, Moab, all these states were made subservient vassal states to the nation of Israel. And they were taxpayers, they were not allowed to have their own governance. But what happened was, as time came and the kingdom split, then each of the kingdoms, the Israel and Yehuda, took different vassal states. So Israel took Ammon and Moab, and Yehuda took Edom, Seir, which were in the south. So they, sort of speak, divided their vassals. And that's why you see that Moab, at the beginning of Sefer Melachim Beis, attacks Israel. And Israel then asks for an alliance with Yehuda. Yehuda brings along Edom, who's a subservient vassal state, to fight against Moab. That's what the Mesha Stili is describing, as the battle where Moab gains its independence of Israel as a vassal state. Here we have Edom is essentially the center of this, says the Da'at Mikra. Ammon and Moab are associating aligning themselves with Edom to fight for the independence from Yehuda at this point in time, which is what's going on here. The Malbim, though, later on in the Perek, points out in Pasuk Chof Gimel, it doesn't make sense that Yehoshaphat should be scared of these subservient states coming to fight them. Meaning, it sounds like Yehoshaphat is truly scared, but his father, Asa, who had a smaller army than him, had fought off the Ethiopians, who had hundreds and hundreds of thousands of troops. So why would he be scared of this, you know, small uprising on the east? Suggests the Malbim that, in fact, it wasn't just these nations. In fact, it was a conglomeration of mercenaries. So they had hired other nations who had come to send their armies as proxies for their independence. And the Malbim says a beautiful thing, whereas if you look at Tehillim, Perek Pei Gimel, the 83rd Mizmor in Tehillim, It describes a huge battle against Israel, and the Malbim suggests that that battle is referring to this perek, Divrei Hayamim Beis, perek Chof, where it talks about all these nations who are coming together to fight the nation of Israel. That is a very, very different way of looking at things, and it makes it more explicable as to what's going on. Yanostal of Milchama. It talks about Pleshes and Yoshe Tzor, all kinds of different nations, Yishmaelim, Bnei Ashur, Inil Vayimam, all these nations, as you read Tehillim Perek Pei Gimel, which explain this idea of what's going on here. Let's move now to the next step. The next step is about fast and prayer. So we hear about from Sukkim Gimel to Yud Gimel, where Yehoshaphat gathers together a large fast day. He brings all of Bnei Yehuda together in Yerushalayim. He gets up in front of them and he turns to HaKadosh Baruch and he says, Hashem, you are the Elohim Hashemayim, you are had the power in all of the heavens, you control all of the nations, all of the earth, no one can stand in front of you. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you gave this land to the seed of Abraham, and you allowed us to build the Beis HaMikdash. When we built the Beis HaMikdash, and he quotes his great-great-grandfather Shlomo HaMelech, when we established this Beis HaMikdash, it was a place to pray when our enemies came against us, and we are now praying to you. And he says, now look, now all these nations, Ammon, Moab, Har Seir, are fighting against us, and you didn't even allow us to attack them. You didn't allow us to kick them out when we came from Egypt. Now they're coming to fight against us. They're spilling forth upon us. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we only have you. Please save us. That's what Yehoshaphat says. And he goes on to describe, and all our women and our children are all in front of you. So just a few things to point out over here is, why is he focusing on the idea in Pasuk Yud that we weren't given the license to destroy these nations? Rashi says the reason is because they're actually from family. But they should have remembered that chesed. We didn't destroy them. They should have remembered that chesed, that we didn't destroy them. But yet, look at them. They're throwing insults onto injury. They are now rejecting that kindness that we showed them. The Malbim says, no. He says, the point that Yehoshaphat is raising is, we didn't even start this. Meaning to say, it wasn't like they have this ancestral, you know, vendetta against us. No, we didn't even attack them in the first place. Why HaKadosh Baruch Hu write this wrong? I would suggest humbly that they are not among the seven nations, and that's what he's emphasizing. If, let's say, this was an Amorite tribe attacking them, then HaKadosh Baruch Hu could say, well, you should have completely destroyed them and vanquished them. The fact that they're attacking you is your problem now. So what Yehoshaphat is emphasizing is that it's not our problem. We were told not to attack them, so that's why they're here. We move on to Pasuk Yud Beis, just a fascinating phrase which appears every day in the Tachanun prayer. And the last section we say, "Anachnu lo neidak en manaseh ki olecha einenu." And that's the point in Tachanun where a person moves from a sitting position to a standing position. What does it mean? "Anachnu lo neidak," we don't know, manaseh, what to do, ki olecha einenu. How do you translate that last phrase? So all the Mefarshim explain, ki olecha einenu, meaning rak olecha einenu, ela einenu olecha, as the Mefarshim say. We only have our eyes on you because we don't know what course of action to take right now. And that's why, by the way, we change from our face down position in Tachanun to sitting position to standing position as we transfer ourselves into a third position when we're praying to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. As a supplication, we say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we don't even know which position is the correct position when davening in front of you. Please, Hashem, help us find the right action. That's what Yehoshaphat is asking. Why is he mentioning the women and children here? So Rashi points out that when there was a siege on a country, the women and the children who would be most vulnerable in the outlying cities and villages would all run and to the major walled cities, and that's Yerushalayim. So he's saying, in front of you, Hashem, are all the refugees from all the villages in the east because of all of this. Please protect them as well. Now, we at this point in time, it's all been Yehoshaphat speaking. Now we hear about the response. So we hear in Pesukim Yudala to Yotes about the response through Yechaziel. We hear about Yechaziel, who's the son of Zechariah, the son of Benayahu, the son of Yiel, the son of Matanya, the lady who's from the children of Asaph. So he suddenly has this prophetic experience, and he turns to everybody who's gathered, and he says, I'm speaking on behalf of Hashem. I just received a prophecy. You should not fear, because of this large nation, this large conglomeration. Don't worry, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to be in charge. He's in charge of words. You go down they're going to go to this place called Ma'ale Atzitz, which seems to be some sort of valley. He says, and don't worry, you're going to find them in as you enter the midbar of Yeruel, go and meet them, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu will bring a salvation. This is amazing, because now the Yehoshaphat has been praying, they've been fasting, and there's an immediate response to their call. And so what happens is that Yehoshaphat prostrates himself, and everybody is bowing down to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and they get up and they burst into song to praise HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The one thing which is noted, the Medrash in Koheles Rabbah points out that when it describes Yechaziel's description of how he prophesizes, it says he was besoich HaKahal, among the community, which means to say that he was not doing this in a arrogant way, he was not doing this in a one-upmanship way, he was besoich HaKahal, and the Medrash emphasizes, and that's why his words were accepted, even though the prospect of what he's suggesting, it requires a great amount of risk, meaning going out, not staying in your walled city, to go out to a very large army of mercenaries does entail an incredible amount of risk, but nonetheless they believe him, he's besoich HaKahal, and that's what they do ultimately. Okay, so what actually happens? So we hear from Sukkim Chof to Lamed, an amazing thing. They get up in the morning and they go out to the Midbar of Tekoa. They go out to the desert, and as they're going out, Yehoshaphat once again reminds everybody that this is in the hands of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And as they go out, we hear this a description of how they're praising and they're singing to Hashem and they're crying out, Hoidu Hashem ki tov ki lelam chastoi, thankful to Hashem forever, his goodness is forever. And they start dancing and they start praising HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And at which point, when Hashem hears this, Hashem allows, he puts places Ma'orvim, which sounds like those who are trapping or those who are attacking, ambushing the Bnei Ammon, the Moav, and at which point when Bnei Israel come there, they find that all of these people are dead. Every single last one of them, there's not a single refugee. They spend 3 days stripping the corpses for the spoils. They put large piles because they can't even carry all of it. And they go on the fourth day to a place called Emek Bracha, the Valley of Bracha, where they bless HaKadosh Baruch Hu because of this incredible victory. And we hear about how there's this unbelievable happiness which ensues, and all the nations of Israel are all the nations surrounding Israel no longer will fight against Yehoshaphat because of this incredible victory, and there was peace in the land because of this moment. Just a few interesting things to think about, and that is, why are they saying Hoidul Hashem Kitov before the battle? Meaning, say it afterwards, we understand, but they're walking into battle singing Hoidul Hashem Kitov. They're thankful to Hashem for his always for good. Why is that? So one thing you see here is the incredible imunah, the incredible faith of the nation of Israel. Here they're told by a prophet, you're going to win this battle, and they know they've won this battle. That's to them, it's incandescently clear to them, even though it is they haven't yet won it. That's one thing you see. The Malbim says you see another thing from here, and that is that what they're thankful for is not for the destruction of the enemy, but for the protection of themselves. Meaning to say, they view HaKadosh Baruch Hu's action not, you know, as an opportunity to watch a blood sport, but rather as a thankfulness for being saved. And this really is the hallmark of a Jewish perspective on battle and war in general. The Jews throughout history are not warmongers. They don't want to kill. They don't want carnage. There's certain times that they need defense, and it needs to be that Israel has a defense force, the IDF, Tzva Haganah Yisrael. Even its name describes that. It's meant to be a defense force. But in the end of the day, no Jew is waiting there and wanting carnage and all kinds of terrible massacres. God forbid. That's the worst thing. But sometimes it's necessary. We thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for protecting ourselves. That's a very different way of looking at war, the necessity of war. It's not something which is to be lauded necessarily. It's something which took the world a long time to catch up to after World War I and certainly after World War II. How is this battle won? So the Maralbag points out, and all the Mephoshim point out, that what happened is here you have this alliance between all these unlikely opposites, all these neighbors, Seir and Ammon and Moab, the Ammonim. So what ends up happening is they all start fighting with each other. Two of them gang up on the other one, then the two that ganged up on the other one now fight against each other, and they ultimately all kill each other, which shows you the level of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's ability. I mean, to say Hashem didn't need to do any miraculous thing, just human. He allowed human nature to take its course. And that's ultimately what happened. They all die. And finally, we hear the last part of the perek, Psukim Lamed Aleph to Lamed Zayin, about the last days of Yehoshaphat. We hear about the fact that he became a ruler when he was 35 years old, and he was ruled for 25 years in Yerushalayim. We hear about the name of his mother, Azuva Bas Shilchi, and we hear that he goes in the way of Asa, his father. He did everything which is straight in the eyes of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but he didn't remove the Bamos, the backyard altars, and the people did not do not fully have their hearts prepared to serve Hashem, their God. But the rest of the, and we're told that the rest of the words of Yehoshaphat are written down in the names of Yehu ben Hanani, who's one of the prophets of the time. We met him before, and is codified both in the Divrei Hayamim for Malchei Yehuda and Malchei Yisrael, because there was a lot of shared territory. On that topic, we end the parak here with this interesting alliance between Yehoshaphat, the king of Yehuda, and Ahaziah, the king of Yisrael, and didn't work out so well in that their shared fleet of ships, which was meant to leave Etzion Gover, which is the south where Elat is, and it was meant to go down to Tarshish to do trade like Shlomo Melech had done, ultimately the ship sank, and at which point in time he was told by the prophet, the last prophet we meet over here, whose name is Eliyahu ben Dodavahu, who tells him it's because you joined with a Rasha, with this evil person, Ahaziah, that's why it is that you were that this happened to you. So a few basic things over here. You see, number one is that it says that the people's hearts were not ready to serve Hashem. What does that mean? After all the Yehoshaphat has done, I mean, it's been so many, you know, moments of education that he's done. So why is that? So the Malbim explains that he, Yehoshaphat himself, was actually doing the right thing, and he would have removed the Bamos, but he was not able to because people were incapable of doing it. I mean, he said this was not about idol worship, this was about serving Hashem, but with the convenience of one's backyard. I mean, like, it's difficult. You have to go to the base of Migdash, you have to find a parking spot for the car, it's cold, it's, you know, the requirement to take a long time to daven, you know, whereas I can have my own little bummer in my backyard, I can sip my coffee, you know, on my deck, I'll get heaters for the so when it's the winter, everything's much more convenient. So that's how Hashem says, that's Asr. Hashem says you're not allowed to do that, you have to go to the base of Migdash. But the people, they weren't ready for this. Even though you had the most righteous king, Yehoshaphat, never quite worked out for the people. The people weren't quite there as well. That's what the Pesukim are saying, says the Malbim. It is interesting to note that in the joint operation with Ahaziah, they had an attempted joint fleet, but ultimately the fleet did sink. Why is this so bad? So what was the problem with joining with the Russia? We see that Yehoshaphat has overtures of trying to unite the kingdom. He tries to unite with his brother-in-law Ahav, and he tries to unite with his nephew Ahaziah, but it's ultimately seen as a bad thing. Why? So the Shari Tshuva quotes an Avos Rabbi Nason, who points out that a person who joins with the Russia, it has negative impact. He lost his fleet. He wasn't as successful as he could have been because of joining with Russia. Meaning to say, you may have good intentions, but if the person you're joining with has no intentions or coming any closer to you, your coming closer to them is going to be seen as a negative action. And that's what's happening over here. So as well intended as Yehoshaphat was, it takes two to tango, and that was not the case over here, which is why it ends on an incredibly high note. Yehoshaphat acting like his father, bringing Torah, bringing leadership, bringing judges to all of Israel, and yet at the same time, his overtures or connection are something which are not seen as positive as much. In the meantime, have a wonderful and meaningful day.